Roy says goodbye. Hello and welcome to episode 35 of this season's Real Football Cast. As always, I'm your host Dan Tracy, and in the next 60 minutes we'll be dissecting all the hot topics in football. As per usual, we'll be discussing what's been going on in the Premier League over the past few days, while in addition to that, there are also some off-pitch activities that have caught our eye and they'll be getting our attention in the next hour. It's been another incredible week of football, and this week we've once again got a full house. That means leading the line and wearing the captain's armband is Carl. So Carl, how have you been since we last spoke?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks Dan. Looking forward to chatting football with you guys as normal, so looking forward to getting into this one.
Lovely stuff. That means you're also joined by Fulham fan Matthew. Matthew, how have you been this past week?
I've been good. It's nice to finally sit back and relax and watch the football without having to do calculations about where Fulham are going to get relegated or not. It's good to finally watch.
I like it. And of course, last but certainly not least, is Palace fan Max. Max, how have you been this past week?
Yeah, good, good. There's some exciting news coming out of the club, which is that we finally scored 3 goals in a match and something else about the manager as well.
Yes, we're going to get to that in a moment. The 3 goals we'll get to at the end. So before we do both of those, I best do the social media bits. Otherwise, we'll be talking to the Abyss once more. First, if you want to get in touch with me, you can. That's on Twitter, at DanTracy1983. Also, the podcast has its own account, which is at RealFootballPod. And if you want to become a shareholder, all you need to do is follow and join our very elite members club. Talking of clubs, I'm delighted to announce we're now part of the UK's first ever sports podcast network, that being Sports Social. So check out the URL and all the links posted throughout the week on the Real Football Pod. You can find me via iTunes by searching for Real Football Cast. If you use that platform, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And if you like us, leave a review so we move up the league table. Also, I need to mention my two content partners. For betting previews, go to betting.com. For thought pieces and opinion, go to nowsport.com. And the easiest way to find all the links is by going to linktree.com/realfootballcast. Put a dot between the R and the E and you get 10 podcast platforms to choose from. It's never been easier to listen to the show. Right, it's time to go live. And where should we go first? I think we need to go to the hottest headline in town, and that is at Selhurst Park. So Max, we can only start with you really. We've been talking about this topic for quite a while now, but it's finally happened. So what do you make of Roy Hodgson's decision to call time on his Palace managerial career?
Yeah, it's really interesting because everyone knows that his contract has been counting down for a long time, right? And so in every press conference for like the last 4 months, he's been an increasingly exasperated Hodgson has been asked the same question over and over and over again by journalists who are just doing their job, to be fair. But you can tell that Hodgson was getting a bit annoyed with it. And, you know, finally now they're announcing it. And I think it makes sense because the timing of it comes just a couple of days before the final home game of the season against Arsenal, which is on Wednesday. And obviously that is going to have fans, a limited number, but still fans in the ground at Selhurst Park. And, you know, that will be an opportunity for the fans that are there to say goodbye to him, to give him a proper send-off, maybe to, you know, give him a traditional kind of Palace banner, which he's had before. And so I think the timing makes a lot of sense. I also think it's good that his contract is running down and we're kind of letting him go, or he's stepping away at the end of a contract rather than him suffering the ignominy of maybe being sacked, because, you know, there have been some not unjustified criticisms about the, you know, the kind of style of play and the age profile of the squad and all of that. But we shouldn't forget he came in after 4 games of, you know, maybe one of the worst decisions in the club's history, which was Frank de Boer. We had 0 points, 0 goals, and, you know, we were the first team ever in the Premier League to lose the first 7 games and to stay up. And since then, he has consolidated us as a Premier League side. He's the only manager in Palace's history to stay in the Premier League for 4 consecutive seasons. And although you might have some criticism about the kind of age of the players he's had and maybe the not so exciting style of play, ultimately his remit, his goal, is to keep us in the Premier League, and on that front he has been a resounding success. So I think I speak on behalf of the vast majority of Palace fans when I say thank you to him for his tenure, for his service. He's done a very good job. He obviously has a a link with the club, having, you know, watched the club on the terraces as a boy, having come through the Palace youth system, and then having returned and had a very significant impact at his boyhood club. I think it's probably the right time for him to maybe step away. But yeah, he's had a really good tenure, and I'm a little bit sad to see him go.
So Matthew, that news happens, and already we're thinking replacements, and we're thinking replacements on this show also. So for discussion purposes, let's chuck some names about. We'll go through a couple or three, shall we say, on this next segment. So for you first, Sean Dyche. He'll be, I guess, the bookies' favourite, because that name has been surfacing since the turn of the year, maybe even longer. Do you think this summer is finally the time he says goodbye to Turf Moor?
I think it is, because I think Burnley, you know, barring that one miraculous season where they managed to finish seventh, I think they are in a situation of, you know, similar to Roy in a way. You know, I've taken them as far as I can go. You know, that one season was a bit of a fluke. The way that the league is sort of progressing right now, I'm not going to do much more for Burnley. I can also make the comparison. It's Tony Pulis with Stoke. It's like, yeah, you get that one team, but for the most part, 12th, 13th, I'm not going to be able to do any more. If you want to bring in someone else that wants to try and do it, by all means do so, but it's not going to be me. So I just want to try something new, because I don't want to be, you know, floating around 12th, 13th, 14th for another 4 or 5 years. So I'm going to try something new. So yeah, it probably is the right time for Dyche to move aside. And, you know, Crystal Palace is probably slightly more attractive. You know, you've got the London pool, which might help him attract players. You've got a brilliant attacking partnership of Zaha and Eberechi Eze that you can build off. So there's a lot of appealing qualities in Crystal Palace. There's obviously the big, massive, like 80,000 players out of contract and what have you. But for the most part, it does seem like an appealing job for someone like Sean Dyche to take a slightly forward step rather than a sideways one.
Okay then, Cole, if we consider Dyche as a favourite, let's say that he doesn't move from Turf Moor and we need to find a new name. What about Frank Lampard? Because one could argue that in his career as a manager, he's had too much too soon. Derby, Chelsea, and you kind of think, well, where can you go from there? Like, in a sense, the only way is down. But could down be Crystal Palace in the summer?
Yeah, I think when you look at it, or, you know, when you consider it's another London club, isn't it? So, you know, that's probably appealing because, you know, obviously we know he's based here. So that could be appealing. Again, it doesn't come with a sort of pressures like that Chelsea job did when he took that over. You know, there was a lot of expectation, especially given the summer transfer window that Chelsea had had. And obviously that probably helped his demise in the end because they were expecting better. And this job might be the job where you can go, OK, well, you've had a little taste with high pressure. You can come into this job and there won't be as much pressure, but obviously then Frank will have to deal with different sort of situations, won't he? You know, he had a decent squad at Chelsea that could play decent football. Whereas obviously if he comes into Palace, you're looking at a completely different setup. And not saying Palace have got completely bad players, but that's more of a project and a building project, isn't it? Where, you know, you're going to be looking to bring in some young players and kind of get things going there again. And the club doesn't have the kind of the same kind of pull that he had at Chelsea. But that might be something that appeals to Frank because he probably would get more of a run and more of a chance to build a project and create something there. We've saw that, you know, he was quite happy to bring through the young players at Chelsea, and that might be one of the remits that Palace want to do, you know, trying to bring through the young blood. And Frank, obviously, you know, got them playing decently. So I wouldn't say that's, you know, an impossible shout, to be honest. It could be a good move for all parties and would help Frank, you know, learn his trade a little bit more as a manager without the same sort of pressures that he had at Chelsea.
Okay then, Max, I'll throw another name to you, another youngish manager. Actually, he is quite young, to be fair. Eddie Howe. Now, he's been considered the Celtic man in terms of replacing Neil Lennon for a long time, but that appointment has been dragging for reasons regarding backroom staff and that kind of thing. Do you think Steve Parrish could act quicker and get Howe to switch from Glasgow to London?
Potentially. And it would actually be a really interesting situation if Howe had... excuse me, if Howe had the choice between Palace or Celtic, because I don't know if you heard the debate between Jim White and Simon Jordan on TalkSport, which is quite interesting about which is a bigger club. I won't comment on all of that now, for fear of stoking further controversy. But how is someone who's been looked at by Palace before? Palace made an offer to him when he was leaving Burnley. In the end, he went back to Bournemouth. So we know that Steve Parish likes him. You know, he's young, he's English, he's managed in the Premier League before, he's got a decent reputation for attacking football, and so maybe wouldn't represent too much of a risk in that circumstance. I think maybe what will concern the board and concern fans like me is the fact that he spent a fair amount of money at Bournemouth. You know, it was always plucky little cherries with their tiny stadium and all of that, but they spent big money on players. You know, 15 million on Jordan Ibe, like 7 million on Brad Smith, who I wouldn't be surprised if you haven't heard of him, is a Liverpool left back, like 20 million on Solanke. You know, they've spent a lot of money on players and they haven't got much return for it. Palace reportedly have a kind of transfer budget of 40 or 50 million this season, but that will not be the case for every season for eternity. You know, that's just a bit of money up front to kind of rebuild the squad, because obviously so many players are leaving, as Matthew mentioned. So I think maybe the financial uncertainty over Eddie Howe might be a factor against getting him. But then, for example, you know, if you go for someone in like Lampard, he's a risk in a different way, or someone from the Championship like Steve Cooper at Swansea or Valerian Ismail at Barnsley, they're also a risk in a different way. You know, Howe has a lot of positives about him, but I wonder if the budgetary stuff might be the reason that we don't go for someone like him.
I'll tell you what, Valerian Ismail is a great shout, because he's done wonders at Barnsley, transformed them in such a short space of time. And I know he's ex-Palace, so when you put two and two together in rumours such as this, it's very easy to get four. But I think that would be a really good shout. But yes, you're right, Max, it does come with its own kind of risk. But Matthew, here's one that's perhaps a little bit more left field, but not that left field. Gareth Southgate. Now, ex-Palace, so a return may be on the cards. It would need either a really bad Euros or England to win and he goes out on a massive high. But if he was available, could a Premier League stint be an option for him?
I think that wouldn't be a bad shout. As you said, it probably does come on, you know, to either end of the spectrum, yeah. Either a complete disaster or disaster for me in England winning it. But yeah, it does. It will have to be from one of those two angles, because I do think there is still this, you know, long-term plan of winning the World Cup and what have you. But in this scenario, I do think that does sound about right, because that's what, you know, his level was at Middlesbrough for a couple of years. And he did okay at Middlesbrough. He slightly tailed off when they eventually got relegated, but different times. Middlesbrough, as I've said, there's probably Crystal Palace now is probably better than what Middlesbrough was then, even though they just come off the UEFA Cup run. But no, I saw there was links about him being linked with the Spurs job. I thought, no, that's far too big. But Crystal Palace, you know, a chance to, you know, reestablish things. I think that's a pretty decent shout. But it would, I can't see that happening, just because I can't see him leaving the England job in any way, shape, or form. But if it were to happen, I think that'd be a fairly good shout.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It comes with huge caveats. But, you know, if he was available, I don't think it's the most outlandish suggestion to make. I know Carl was very anti-Gareth Southgate when I asked him about Spurs last night, so I'm not going to ask the same question there. But what I will ask, Carl, that if Gareth Southgate or whoever takes the Palace job, there's 11 players out of contract. Now, I don't know if they're all going to depart. I'll ask this to Max in a moment. But this Palace team, this Palace squad is going to look really different. Now, half the job's going to be bringing in new faces, the integration. So it's a case of hitting the ground running, and it's going to be really, really important for that man to do so.
Anytime, as a new manager, you go in and obviously you get a pre-season and that, then you do need to hit the ground running, especially in this league, don't you? Because, you know, if you suddenly get yourself too far behind, it's a hard fight to kind of pull it all back, as we saw, you know, Matthew would probably say, you know, Fulham, they gave it a really good go, but probably gave themselves a little bit too much to do with their early season form. So it is important that a new manager goes in, you can get the balance right at the, you know, during pre-season, and everything goes well, and you get off to a relatively good start, because we've seen the league's not forgiving, chairmen are not forgiving, and while you know, Palace have stuck with Roy because he kind of is a steady hand who, you know, even if you go on a couple of bad results, you know that he's got that knowledge and know how to kind of get it back on and get you going in the right direction. I think, you know, a new man that goes in, if the season doesn't start as well, the chairman gets a little bit, you know, twitchy, players start to suddenly have a bit of a moan and groan, and before you know it, you know, they're looking at the Premier League survival, and you're giving, before you know it, it's not long before you're giving Big Sam a call and asking him to come in and kind of just keep you up for another season. So whoever goes in there will need to try and make sure they get a right balance and get off to a really good start. Otherwise, it could be a really short tenure.
Now, Max, it's not quite 80,000. It's 11 players out of contract. Out of those, how many, if any, will you retain? Give us a rough estimate in terms of a number. Bonus points, if you can actually put some names to that as well.
Yeah, of course. I've been, obviously, like many Palace fans, kind of thinking about it and discussing who I'd probably keep. Interestingly, the Athletic's Palace reporter, Matt Woosnam, or one of the Palace reporters, did an article the other day kind of detailing, kind of hinting at who would go and who would stay. Let me take you through all of them. So in goal, Wayne Hennessy is going to go, I suspect. All of these are kind of educated guesses rather than kind of confirmed facts. But okay. I reckon Hennessy will go. Stephen Henderson will stay as third choice keeper. Joel Ward will stay fullback, obviously right back, on reduced terms. We've offered him reduced terms. Nathaniel Clyne might stay. Depends if on Nathan Ferguson's fitness, because we signed Ferguson last summer and he's literally been out the whole season injured. If it looks like he's going to take a long time to get back, we might give Clyne another short-term contract. Van Aanholt is going to leave. Palace are not thinking about signing a second choice or a left-back, another left-back for competition because of how well Tyrick Mitchell has done. At centre-back, Mamadou Sakho is going to go. He's on massive wages, apparently north of 100 grand a week. And he's only played about 6 games this season because of really bad injuries. Gary Cahill and Scott Dann are likely to stay for another year as cover, even though they're really getting on a bit. I would expect both of them to stay for a year and to leave next summer. In midfield, James McCarthy is likely to go. A couple of other Premier League teams and Celtic are interested in him, I reckon. Andros Townsend and Christian Benteke are the ones whose futures are kind of up in the air because both of them have been pretty much first team players this season, regular first teamers this season. Obviously Benteke has come into real form. I think he scored like 5 in the last 9 games or something, which is absurd because he'd scored 5 combined in the last 2 seasons before this season, you know. So it's really been a big turnaround from him. And then Connor Wickham is very likely to go as well. So that is a rundown of what's happening.
An excellent rundown. That's exactly what we needed, Max. Thank you very much. Right, let's talk cup finals, and one in particular, the FA Cup final. Carl, now, admittedly, I've been, and I think to a certain degree, we've all been, actually, no, Matthew hasn't been, critical of the FA Cup in recent times, but I think Saturday's 90 minutes was a perfect advert for how good this competition can be.
Yeah, I think in many ways, the end result was exactly what the kind of FA and the media would have been pleased about, won't they? You know, it's that, you know, the underdogs in the game come through and win it in the end, a team that, you know, everyone, I think, was kind of rooting for them. Unless you were a Chelsea fan, I think everyone else was kind of rooting and hoping Leicester would win it. And they suddenly go and pull it off. And also, you know, you've got, you know, the two incidences, you know, the goal that is kind of every cup final's dream, isn't it? You know, to score a goal like that in a cup final and win the game for your team, it is schoolboy stuff and something that you dream about. And then obviously you get the controversy with the goal that's ruled out offside that just kind of adds that little bit of hype to it. You know, I've got a few Chelsea supporters who seem to think that, you know, things go against them far too often in finals. And that, you know, it's a coincidence that they get that decision when it's Leicester, and that certain, you know, entities would want Leicester to win and Chelsea not to win that final. But I thought it was a good game. And the result for me, as you say, is one that I think gives the FA Cup a little bit of life, doesn't it? Because, again, it is that great story that the FA Cup throws up. The underdog wins on the day, and it's by a dream goal. So I think it will spark a little bit more life. I think it gives it that little bit of edge again for next season. And obviously fans being there played a massive part in that, didn't it? Because, you know, the goal and the celebrations, and then obviously the VAR incident, and you get that one moment Chelsea fans going mad, and then the next moment the big roar from the Leicester end, and it all added to it. And I think it does breathe a little bit of life back into it, which is great.
Yeah, I mean, the FA Cup has a habit of just chucking up great things when you think it's just dying off, and then it sort of recaptures that love. I'm probably being quite hypocritical because I have scathed this competition quite a bit recently. But I think for me, Matthew, the best thing of all, as Carl's alluded to, 20,000 fans, a great goal, but just the roar of a crowd. And I'm grinning about it now because it's such a good feeling and such a good spectacle to see that. And you kind of think football as its best is not that far away now, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I've been sort of somewhat critical about this whole narrative, you know, football without fans is nothing. I think that's going a little bit too far. You know, as we've shown, we've just gone through a whole Premier League season. It's been a bit weird, but football can go on without fans. You know, and there's always this thing like Man United don't need fans in the ground because they make money from speeches. So it's different. I'm not disputing that, but it's not nothing. I'm not getting on that line. But I will admit that it was incredibly special. I think because I was listening to the game on Five Live because I was coming back from something else, and the broadcasters, and I've seen the highlights as well from other places, the broadcasters did a fantastic job in painting this whole thing. And, you know, when Leicester won the cup, and, you know, they're talking about the fans and what Leicester as a city have been through this whole pandemic and everything like that, I'm not ashamed to admit that I was nearly on the verge of tears just listening to it all, because it was an incredibly romantic and incredibly emotional day. And as you said, the FA Cup, I'm a big fan of the FA Cup. I do still think the magic is there. And that game and that scenario and everything that went into it just perfectly summed up what is special about the FA Cup. And then you can transcribe that into, you know, what football is going to be like. And we're getting the fans back. You know, we had fans back at the Championship playoff final last night. Again, fans back tonight. It is going to be something special. It's not completely dead when fans aren't there, but it is incredibly important.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Tielemans' goal as a perfect example, if he scores that in front of an empty Wembley, you'd feel so bad for him because it's such a great goal, worthy of winning any cup final. It needs that roar. And I just think that in itself made it such a great spectacle and a great afternoon for Leicester and for football as a whole. But Max, in terms of that goal, we're looking at it from the Chelsea point of view. Chelsea fans are saying that if Edouard Mendy's in goal, it's not a goal. Now, it's very easy to say that, and it's hard to sort of prove or disprove, of course. But do you think Leicester identified Kepa's relative weakness and thought, actually, that's where we need to target?
To be honest, I think that's a bit unfair. I think maybe fans are reading a little bit too much into that, given the previous travails of Kepa and you know, the previous generally good form of Mendy. It's possible that Mendy's a little bit taller and maybe has a bit more of a kind of a longer reach. But ultimately, I would say the main reason that Kepa didn't really get near it is because he was unsighted by Thiago Silva in front of him. And that would have been the case for Mendy as much as it would have been for Kepa. So I think it's maybe a little bit harsh. I think it was just ultimately a fantastic goal right in the top corner in the postage stamp. And even if he had a completely unsighted view of it, it would have been a tough ask for Mendy or Kepa or indeed any keeper to get there. So I think that might be a little bit OTT. But it was, yeah, a fantastic goal. Tielemans is just a super player. What a player.
Yeah, I think really you've just got to look at it from a great goal. Sometimes we try and overanalyse things and look for the blame. And sometimes you just need to say, in essence, it's just a fantastic strike and worthy, like I say, winning any cup final. But Cole, the goalkeeper, you know, Max has just kind of poo-pooed my theory perhaps about the ability of another keeper to save it. But there is an argument of a cup final that although the fashion is play your reserve goalkeeper to give them minutes where they can't get them in the league, really in a showpiece event such as that, should you not be playing your strongest team wherever possible?
I guess the hard thing here, doesn't it, is that, you know, you kind of sit there and go, if you've played your second choice goalkeeper all the way up to the final and he's one of the players that's got you there, you know, a lot of people think, don't they, that, you know, suddenly it'd be really harsh to suddenly just say, come the final, sorry, mate, you're not in, I'm playing my first choice, you know, I know you got us here. And you've done all right in those games, but I'm not picking you in the final. And it can seem a little bit harsh, but then I sort of think that that's where a manager really earns his money, doesn't it? Because, you know, you have to be harsh at times and say, well, listen, if I want to win something, then I might have to make tough decisions at tough times that upset people. And actually, I want to play my strongest players in this final now. Yeah, tough one. I think, as you say, it, you know, to suddenly sit there and look back in hindsight and think, well, maybe another goalkeeper saves that, could be a bit harsh. It's a great finish. But then you look at the other end and see the saves that have been pulled off at the other end. Think, well, wow, there's the example of making sure you do play your best goalkeeper in a big game. I am a little surprised, because I think if you're, you know, especially when you consider you're a new manager that's coming, you've done really well and you've got a chance early doors to kind of get a first bit of silverware to your name, and especially given that, you know, a little while before, you know, a few days before that, you've kind of potentially put yourself in a bit of spot of bother in the league as well by slipping up in a game that you really probably should have been favourites to win, and now you've given yourself a real kind of dilemma going into the last couple of games with another big final coming. I'd have thought there maybe the manager says, well, listen, yeah, I need to get this over the line, because if we can get this over the line, that kind of takes a little bit of pressure off me. Whereas if we don't get this game over the line, we don't get the next final over the line, and suddenly we slip up in the next two league games, I suddenly go from being a brilliant appointment to suddenly with a bit of egg on my face and looking very silly. It's a hard one, though, isn't it? I think it's very harsh on Kepa if he's not picked. But then I think a manager's there to earn his money. And if you think you've got a better goalkeeper in a final, you should probably play him and just make sure you get it over the line. But who knows? It's always easy to look back with hindsight, isn't it? If they win it comfortably, then it's not even a discussion point, is it?
Absolutely. I was just about to say the same, that if Chelsea win the cup, no one cares about who's in between the sticks. But Matthew, VAR once again at centre stage. It was harsh for Chelsea, but really, it was the right decision. It's not as if VAR got it wrong and we're talking about controversy coming out of Wembley. If anything, that's the kind of drama we want to see from technology. And is that drama, again, aided by the fans? Because if it's an empty Wembley, it's just sent back to as a free kick and we just, you know, the game goes on. But that kind of celebrating of a non-goal is almost just as good as scoring itself.
Exactly. You point out exactly the celebration of a non-goal is just important. This is why I don't want to hear the argument that VAR is taking the emotion out of the game, because listen to the roar that the Leicester fans had. And it's the same reaction I had. Remember the Man City Spurs UEFA Champions League one, yeah, when Sterling was adjudged or had his goal taken out because Aguero was offside? Go back and listen to that and listen to the Spurs fans cheering after the goal is ruled out, and then tell me that VAR is taking the emotion out of the game. It's just absolute nonsense in my mind. And again, you have the despair of the Chelsea fans in that situation. And there's this clip going around of the Chelsea fans celebrating, not realising they're in a beer garden or something. So it is fantastic. And as you say, VAR, it is in this situation. That's what we want to see. It got it absolutely right. Yes, it was a marginal offside, but it was offside. And in this situation, yeah, that was another one I saw. You know, the big clubs are going to be helped out by this VAR because, you know, they're going to get away with it. It proved that no, that the big clubs are being punished as well. They're being punished, you know, equally. If someone makes defence, they're going to get called out for it. So it was brilliant that it was brought in for precisely this reason, and it was, you know, adjudged correctly. So, you know, the result was fair in the end.
Absolutely. Now, Max, in terms of Leicester winning the FA Cup, the argument of the Big Six has reared its head again. Is there something to be said that the Big Six will always be the Big Six? That kind of fence is not ever going to open. However, you can make a case for the Best Six being slightly different. So is the Big Six terminology slightly too rigid in this day and age?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think as long as you kind of qualify it by saying they're the self-styled Big Six, or Big Six in inverted commas, because they obviously consider themselves the Big Six in terms of maybe history and previous quality kind of and their historic successes, as we saw in the European Super League. But arguably, they're not the best six. And, you know, Arsenal might finish like ninth. Tottenham could well finish outside the top six, the six highest places in the Premier League. You know, Leicester might be part of it. West Ham might be part of it. Everton might sneak in. You know, you don't know. So I think it is. I don't think it's a very good kind of catch-all term. I think you can use it as long as you're talking about, you know, the fact that they consider themselves the Big Six, but as we're likely to see in the final Premier League table, that is, you know, not necessarily corresponding to reality.
Yeah, I think you can also see this with Sky and the way they kind of now add in the traditional Big Six. There's like extra levels of caveats, but again, really that's their phrase and they try and market the Big Six as much as they can, so they can't really kind of kill it off themselves. So it's trying to keep it relevant, and then Leicester are trying to gatecrash the club. And although they won't really be ever accepted, as you say, Max, it's kind of in its own kind of group where if you look at the Big Six versus the best six per season, you're not always going to have a perfect match. And I think that's the scenario we're going to have in a week or so's time when the season comes to an end. But, Cole, Leicester versus Chelsea, they meet again tonight, Tuesday, so we can't really talk about it. But we can talk about the race for the top four, because that's really heating up. And Liverpool are making a late charge because of an incredible end to their trip to West Brom on Sunday. You literally, even if you tried, you could not write that ending, could you?
No, that again, that's kind of like Roy of the Rovers stuff, isn't it? You know, last minute, the goalkeeper goes up and scores a fantastic header. It is Roy of the Rovers stuff that kind of, you know, goalkeepers all dream about, don't they? Going up flat last minute, getting your header on one or sticking one away. I think, you know, the last time we saw something like that, I think, was it Glass? Yeah, something Glass scored for...
Jimmy Glass.
Yes, Carlisle. That's it. Yeah, Carlisle, that's it. And it was like the last kick of the game, wasn't it? And kept them up. And that, again, you kind of sit and go, well, wow, what a fairy tale that was. And it's great when you see that sort of stuff from a goalkeeper and they go up and they get a brilliant header on it like that. I guess you have that thing, don't you, that, you know, it's quite easy for teams to switch off. I think we don't really need to mark the goalkeeper. He's just here to cause a nuisance. And maybe it'll just sharpen a few teams up. And I think, well, look, these goalkeepers nowadays are actually quite good footballers now. You know, it's gone from the old days where they weren't particularly great footballers. These guys can all play. They can pass the ball as well as some midfielders. And it looks like, you know, Alisson's probably been practising his headers a bit like a centre-half, because it was a great header and a great story that wins them the game. And really gives them a shout going into these last two fixtures, doesn't it? Of actually squeezing in and suddenly saving what's been a pretty poor season for Liverpool.
Yeah, I mean, it's on, isn't it? And Matthew, last week you were spending some smart money, so let's get it out again. Leicester and Chelsea play Tuesday night, so there's going to be drop points somewhere. Who out of those two, if anyone, will fall out of the top four and finish fifth this season? Where's that smart money going now?
Ask me later tonight after I know the result of the game. But in all seriousness, I think it will probably be Leicester, because I think Chelsea are going to want to. Yeah, it's the perfect time. It's a revenge game for them. So I just think tonight is going to be, I think it's going to be Chelsea's night. And I know that the way that the maths works and everything, Leicester have still got a big game coming up on the final day of the season. And Liverpool are on a resurgent charge. I know if Liverpool win all their games, that because of the math, the way the maths work, that they've got they're into the top four. I just think Leicester, after the emotional high that they've gone off, I just don't see how they can, you know, I don't think how they can keep that up. And at the same time, I think Chelsea are going to really going to be going for it. So I think Chelsea win tonight, and then that's probably advantage to them. Liverpool catch up. So I think it's probably going to be Leicester. At the point of recording, 20 minutes to 3 on the Tuesday, I say Leicester fall out.
Okay, I like the way you timestamp that. But I think you're right in the sense that, in a perverse way, Leicester winning the FA Cup is probably the worst thing that can happen to their Champions League aspirations. I think there will be a hangover tonight, Tuesday. And I just feel that then it's not in their hands. So I feel that, yes, they'll miss out on the top four. But what price do you put on that day, Saturday? And arguably, some fans would say, do you know what, after losing 4 FA Cup finals previously as a club, then this is priceless in itself. So that's an argument that we can discuss if it does happen and they fall out. But Max, another fallout, England, Trent Alexander-Arnold, because England have what, 10, 11 right backs you could choose from? Maybe not that many. But no matter how many Gareth Southgate takes out of his 26, it looks like TAA is not going to be on the bus. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I'm pretty surprised. Mm. I'm pretty surprised, to be honest, because Klopp was probably a little bit heavy-handed talking about, you know, what a disgrace it was when he wasn't picked in the initial squad. I think at that time, it was the right decision because he was very out of form and there were a couple of other right-backs who were in pretty good form. You know, Trippier is likely to win La Liga with Atletico. Reece James has been very good for Chelsea, seems to have finally broken through into that senior first team. And Kyle Walker is obviously regularly playing right back for, you know, the, arguably the best team in Europe. So at that point, you know, Klopp was just kind of pandering to his Liverpool audience by being a little bit melodramatic about it. However, Trent has since come back into very, very good form. Fair play to him. He wasn't in great form. And, you know, you can say that about the whole Liverpool team. It wasn't only him underperforming. And it's obviously difficult to perform in a team where things aren't going right generally. But he has really stepped it up since then. And so I'd be very surprised if he doesn't get in the squad. Now, you could say, well, maybe if Southgate is thinking about playing a wing-back system, you know, three centre-backs and then wing-backs, that maybe Trent wouldn't suit that. But then he's going to take Luke Shaw, and Luke Shaw has played in a back four all season. So I don't think that's a reason for you not to take Trent. He is a fantastically gifted young footballer, and he was in bad form earlier in the season when he was left out of the previous England squad for the international break. But since then, as I say, he's been really good. And I think he's definitely in the top two right backs in England, you know, and he would make how many other squads for Euros, for other teams in the Euros? How many starting teams for other sides in the Euros? So I'm just really surprised that if he doesn't make it, because I think he definitely deserves to be there. And actually, arguably, I would say Aaron Wan-Bissaka deserves to be there as well. Considering his defensive strengths for Manchester United. But I suspect Wan-Bissaka won't go either. It'll be really interesting to see who he picks. Obviously, it's maybe England's strongest position in terms of options they have, but I think Trent warrants going on the plane.
Well, let's have a look. You've got Kyle Walker, you've got Trippier, Trent, Wan-Bissaka, Reece James. There's five. I think really you can take three maximum out of a squad of 26. Probably Wan-Bissaka, although you make a good case, will probably miss out. And I think, knowing Gareth Southgate and his logic, it would be a surprise, but I actually feel that Trent might miss out, because I just think Gareth Southgate is prone to these weird decisions, and I think that might be the weirdest one of them all. But talking of weird decisions, Cole, Mike Dean, he was at the centre of attention for the wrong reason. Actually, he loves the centre of attention, so maybe the right reasons. But his free kick decision, I've watched this back countless times, and I still have no idea as to why Liverpool were awarded a free kick. Do you have any idea?
No, it is a strange one, isn't it? Because, as you say, given the actual incident itself, the theory should have been, it should have just been one of those drop ball situations, shouldn't it? But for some reason, he seems to give the free kick in Liverpool's way. And quite rightly, everyone is questioning, well, hang on a minute, what have you given a free kick for? And you can only assume it's going to be one of them that he's going to have to get pulled up and asked, isn't it? So like, well, you know, come on, why did you give a free kick there? And that clearly wasn't a free kick situation one way or the other. And he might get his wrist slapped. But the problem with that is we'll never know, will we? Because no one's going to come out and suddenly go, well, yep, listen, we've pulled him in. We've had a word with him on this and, you know, asked him or grilled him as to why he did that. It'll just be dealt with behind closed doors. But like as you say, I think ultimately at the end of it, I mean, Mike Dean's probably rubbing his hands after this weekend, isn't he? A couple of incidents in that game, and he's probably again is kind of in the headlines, and he probably, you know, saying no, Mike Dean and the way he seems to work, I don't think he kind of minds that. So I'm sure he's not, he won't be too unhappy. But yeah, if you're West Brom and Sam Allardyce, quite rightly, is sitting there saying, well, yeah, it's cost us. And there's no real reason why that should have cost us. But I think, you know, we won't know what's gone on there or what the outcome of that is. Unfortunately, it's just another incident you put down in a season of really bad ones.
Yeah, exactly. We won't see the fallout, and it'll just be a case of Mike Dean admonished behind closed doors, and they'll get another game probably over midweek or at the weekend, and life goes on. But Matthew, in terms of Liverpool's equaliser, now, you could argue that the free kick result has resulted in the goal, but you could also argue that West Brom had countless opportunities just to put their foot through the ball and get clear, and they didn't. So how much of the decision to Will this strange free kick is responsible for the goal, or how much is it really West Brom being West Brom?
I think it's pretty much equal. You know, it's one of these things. It never does come down to this one decision. If you look over it at the course of the 90 minutes, there are always chances for you to sort yourself out, whether it be you scoring at the other end or you being better defensively, which is something we never really say about Big Sam sides. They're usually pretty good defensively, but yeah, it's a mixture of things. You can't really put it on one side or the other. They probably, you know, in effect, they probably share the blame on this instance.
Okay, then talking of blame though, Max, West Brom will be blaming the officials for what they thought at the time was a late winner. Cole Bartley had a header scrubbed off, that being because of Matt Phillips in the line of sight of Alisson. Was that the right decision?
Oh, it's a really tough one, isn't it? It's a really tough one. A lot of people see it as controversial because they kind of say Alisson would have never got there, and that is probably true, but that is not a consideration for the VAR. If I may, I'll read a little bit from the Lord Almighty Dale Johnson's Twitter thread. So he says, let's dissect the West Brom goal. Obviously, some see this as controversial. Giving offside against a player who doesn't play the ball is by its nature a subjective aspect of the offside law. So the key section of the law itself, the wording, he says, is preventing an opponent from playing or being able to play the ball by clearly obstructing an opponent's line of vision. So it doesn't matter whether Alisson can see the ball or not. The critical question is, does Phillips being in front of Alisson impact on how the goalkeeper can play the ball or how quickly he can react? So it's not about Phillips kind of blocking Alisson's movement or anything, which he obviously didn't. He wasn't like right in front of him, but it's how he can challenge for the subsequent ball. It's also not important whether Alisson will definitely save the ball when it drops to Bartley. It's about whether Phillips kind of impacts his ability to challenge for it. So basically, he says, Johnson says that the decision was never going to be overturned once it was given, because there's definitely not enough evidence to overturn it. But it is a very subjective aspect of the law. And although Matthew was saying earlier that, you know, VAR is even-handed in that it does give decisions against the bigger teams, that's definitely true. You know, it's not the case that Liverpool never ever get a VAR decision against them and West Brom always 100% of the time do. But I would say, similar to regular refereeing decisions, there is a slight accidental, I'm not saying it's a whole conspiracy against smaller teams or anything, but I would say there's probably an accidental slight weighted bias towards the bigger teams, which is kind of natural if you think about it. And I would say that applies to VAR decisions as well as to regular refereeing decisions throughout the course of the match. So West Brom will say, we're a small team and we haven't had a lot of luck with these decisions in this game at all. Would this goal have been allowed if it was Liverpool scoring it? Who can say? You know, we'll never know. But they definitely have a grievance, West Brom, I think.
Yeah, the topic of unconscious bias is a fascinating one, really, because it's one that you can't really ever prove. You can look at VAR decisions and add on points and goals and all that and try and rejig the table, but it is always kind of, it's always a narrative that's going to be there, and it's always similar to when people say that the Premier League is fixed. Now, I don't think referees are on the take, Carl. I just think that they are, as a whole, rather inept at times, aren't they?
Yeah, I guess the problem is, isn't it, is I always kind of have a little bit of a defence with refs, because when you kind of consider as well, some of them are just inept, and some of the decisions that get made, you go, wow. But then some of the times you think things happen in the blink of an eye on a football pitch, don't they? And, you know, it's only until you maybe ref a game sometimes at any level that you realise how much, like, you know, both players are chirping on at you all the time. Every decision you make is getting a moan. If you do give one that you think, well, it might have been iffy, suddenly you've got that in the back of your mind and you think, do I kind of even it up? I think the biggest worry that we've got is that some of these decisions that are being got wrong are still being gotten wrong when VAR's having a chance to look at them. And I think that's the real worry, because you know, what we wanted to see is I think everyone can accept a ref on a pitch might make a mistake, given that they get, you know, split seconds to think about it and they're making X amount of decisions throughout a game. But when someone else can then sit there and watch some replays of an incident and get different angles and it slowed down and everything like that, when they then still come to the wrong conclusion after all of that, that's where you sit and go, well, that is where it's worrying. And that's obviously when, you know, if things, decisions go the way of the big sides, people suddenly get their view that, well, you know, it's all well and good because the top sides are always going to benefit from this kind of thing. So I still think, we, you know, I like the idea of, we always haven't, we, Dan, like the idea of VAR. We think the technology's good. It's just there's still obviously a lot of work to go, isn't it, to kind of get everyone on board and make sure that the right decisions get given when they should and that VAR is being used in the right instances. But it is a worry when things are being looked at again and still the wrong decision, technically, as far as we feel as fans, is being made, because you think, well, the person in that VAR room has been able to see different angles and had multiple looks and they've still come to the wrong conclusion. And that's when it gets a little bit frustrating.
Yeah, I'm sure that frustration will fall into next season, because it will be, because referees are referees. But one issue which will solve itself in the week to come is the race of the top six, a race that, Cole, at the moment, Spurs are winning. So if I was to ask you right now that Europa League football, and not Europa Conference League football, was on the menu for Thursday next season, would you take it?
I think in the grand scheme, as a club, if you want progression, you'd sit there and go, well, yes, you know, it's not the European competition ideally you want to be in. But then I think for, in terms of revenue and pull for players, it's the best, you know, it's the next best thing. And ultimately, it's what you need to be in. You've got that mix again of it, your Thursdays and Sundays, which, you know, I don't think anyone likes if you're in the Europa League. You know, the group stages are not great. You know, we saw this year, Dan, didn't we? It was a bit of a slog to get through those group stages and the games that you play. But ultimately, I think, you know, if you've got to be in one, you don't want to be in that conference one, because I think that suddenly, you know, makes you a little bit of a, I know it's that laughing stock, but it's, you know, it does. It's, oh, you're in the conference one, are you? Yeah, that's your level. So ultimately, if it's going to be Europe, then we need it to be the Europa League. And we do need to try and go and give it a real crack, because we should be able, you know, we shouldn't have been out when we were this season, and we should have been having a look at trying to be in the final this year. So that's hope. If we do get it, we can give it a better punt than we have this season.
And Matthew, we're less than a month away from the Euros. Bale watch. Are you happy with him at the moment?
He's fit. That's all that really matters. That's all that really matters for me. I said I don't care about the goals he's getting, so long as he's staying fit. That's all that matters.
Okay, and I'll stay with you, because West Ham are sliding down the table. It's still in their hands for a seventh place finish, and they'd be in the Europa Conference League as things stand. But even a month or so ago, that's not quite what David Moyes and his men had in mind. So there's going to be a little bit of disappointment if they do only end up finishing seventh.
I think there will be some element of disappointment again, because it's similar to Leicester last year. You know, they had the Champions League in their hands for so long, and then it's sliding down. Based on the what you wanted at the start of the season, yes, being in Europe is probably better than where you wanted to be. But having been where you were, now it's a bit of a step down. So it really does depend on how you see the situation. Personally, I think, again, looking at, you know, the level of competition that is in the Europa Conference League, it should be something that I think West Ham as a club should be looking forward to. Yes, it may be, you know, quote unquote beneath someone like Spurs, who have been to the Champions League final, have gone to Europa League, and maybe Arsenal, who have gone deep in the Europa League in the past, and so on and so forth. But for a club like West Ham, in the grand scheme of things, I think Europa Conference League, yes, it's not the Europa League, but it's European football at the London Stadium, which was what the No, I'm pretty sure they didn't envision the Conference League, but it's what the owners were sort of promising them when they moved to the London Stadium. So it's a halfway house, in a sense. They probably should be happy in the grand scheme of things, but I imagine there will be a number of West Ham fans that think, oh, this is what we could have got when it comes to the Europa League, and be slightly disappointed.
And Max, when it comes to disappointment, I think there's more in the blue half of Merseyside, because they played Sheffield United at home on Sunday, and really, you'd be putting your house on the Toffees to pick up maximum points. and in turn making that battle for 6th/7th even more tense. However, it looks like they may have even thrown away their potential ticket to Europe next season.
Yeah, and they have got absolutely no one to blame but themselves, because their home form, their form at Goodison Park, has been absolutely woeful. Sheffield United have been by far the worst team in the Premier League this year, possibly one of the worst Premier League teams for like the last 5 years. They're already relegated, and to turn in that kind of performance at home with, you know, the vast, vast majority of your players fit, and look at the starting lineup they put out. It's not like they've got like 8 key first team players out injured, Everton. And so for them to lose at home, you know, they've really got no one else to blame but themselves. Had they won that, you know, there's no guarantee they would have secured European football, but they would have been in a much better position. Now they're unlikely to, and it is all their own fault.
Okay, the most entertaining game of the weekend was on Tyneside as Newcastle played Manchester City. And Matthew, I know you wanted to talk about Scott Carson. I don't know what you want to talk about, but the floor is now yours.
Basically, I don't get what all the fuss was and all the romanticising about Scott Carson playing. It was his first Premier League game in 10 years, I think, was one of the things that got thrown out. If I'm being brutally honest, if I'm a Manchester City, you know, under 18 or under 23 goalkeeper, or at the very least, Zach Stefan, their backup keeper, I'm livid in this situation. Why are you giving a game, a Premier League game? Yes, I get that, you know, it means nothing because the title is all wrapped up. But if you're giving a game based on sentiment, I mean, surely this is Pep Guardiola and his, you know, the serial winner and everything. Surely you'd want to give that game to a younger goalkeeper so that he can get some development minutes. I don't get what the fuss is with why and everyone's all going, oh, great to see Scott Carson get a guard of honour. No. If I'm a Man City fan, or as I said, a Man City player, a young goalkeeper, I'm absolutely fuming, thinking, hang on, why are we giving a younger player a game rather than this, you know, I don't want to say it, but has been goalkeeper. In fact, probably not even a has been, probably a never was goalkeeper in the form Scott Carson. So I just don't get what all the fuss was about personally.
Well, it's the curse of the homegrown goalkeeper, isn't it? The quota filler that you never really played bar this example. And it's like Carson, Rob Green, Ross Turnbull. It's the easiest job in the world as a footballer. And I think really, almost out of pity, Pep Guardiola selected him. But you're right, Matthew. It's kind of like, okay, well, it's just Scott Carson. Like, I don't really see the fuss. But anyway, Carl, there's a lot of fuss about Joe Willock on Tyneside. He scored again at the weekend. Can Steve Bruce tempt him to a permanent move? Or will Willock say, yeah, but you've only really played me. Like, I've been doing great things in limited minutes. Where's my opportunity? So with that in mind, is this really only going to be a short-term move?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I think as a young player, you know, he probably couldn't do himself any harm by staying and having another season there, because with the flashes he's shown so far, you know, you'd like to think that he's put himself in the shop window for more game time next season. Is he going to go back to the club, his main club, and get more minutes? Probably very doubtful. You know, he might only get used as a bit part player there. So I think he's a player who probably could do with a season or so down at, you know, with a club like Newcastle, and maybe try and get more first team minutes and come through and develop there. It's not done other players in the past any harm. He's looking a good prospect. If he can keep that sort of form going and kind of build on that now next season, then, you know, the future is looking bright for him. He's been impressive, but he will be knocking on the door, won't he, saying, look, if you do want to keep me, then I want some kind of confirmation that I'll be one of your key players next season. Otherwise, if not, then I might look to see where else I can go, where I am guaranteed a few more minutes, because I'm starting to show that I could be worth it.
And Max, what did you make of Ferran Torres stealing the show with a fantastic goal on Tyneside? Is he going to be a slow burner in the sense that Riyad Mahrez was, that moved for big money, didn't quite sort of take the first team by the scruff of the neck to start with, and people are thinking, you know, is he a bust? And now Mahrez is starting to come really good. So does next season bode really well for the ex-Valencia man?
Yeah, I think so. And I'm not saying he's going to break into the first team at City next season, because even if they don't sign a striker, which I think they will this summer, you know, their current front three is Mahrez, De Bruyne, Foden, and what fantastic players they all are, you know. So he was never going to kind of come in his first season age like 20. He's now 21. And then, you know, kind of just boss things immediately and be playing 50 games and starting all of them. because City are one of the best sides in Europe. But he has shown enough potential this season to show he can be a really big part of the squad next season. Obviously, they'll be fighting on a lot of fronts, you know, all the domestic cup games, all the Premier League games, Champions League, potentially like the European Super Cup and Club World Cup and stuff like that if they, you know, win the Champions League final. And he's a young, as I say, he's only 21. He's versatile. He can play kind of wide left, wide right. We saw him, his ability as a number nine, as a central striker, with that hat-trick against Newcastle. And Guardiola actually said after the game, he's proven to me that he can be a number nine. So definitely, he's a really good young player, and he's a worthy part of that squad. He's obviously come in after Sané left for Bayern Munich, and he's providing a bit of cover. And yeah, as I say, I don't think he'll be first choice, but he's a really good, talented young player, and I'm sure he's got a big future at the club.
Right, we've got about 4 minutes left, so it's the quickfire round. Carl, I'll start with you. Burnley, a very un-Burnley performance at the weekend. They shipped 4 goals to Leeds.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it? Not a sort of performance you'd expect to see from them. They've been on some good form lately, but just very blunt. Didn't really look on it at all. And maybe that's now just the fact, you know, safe, just seeing these last games out. But Leeds really impressive and did a good job on them. And I guess now Burnley just thinking, well, we are safe. We'd shown a bit of form. We just try to build on next season. And of course, they will have their minds about whether Dyche will be there or not next season and whether they can kind of progress or where do they go. But a very un-Burnley-like performance. But Leeds, you know, did a very good job on them and very dangerous going forward.
Max, you've got 60 seconds because the Roy news has overshadowed a 3-2 win over Villa on Sunday. What did you make of that one?
Yeah, it was really nice to watch, actually. I think it was the Premier League game with the second most shots this season, which is absolutely bizarre for Crystal Palace. You know, I would not have expected that statistic to come through. But twice we came from behind. The defence was pretty shoddy for the 2 goals we conceded, but the response was very good. And what a fantastic fact it is that Tyrick Mitchell, the young left back from the academy, has come through and he was superb. He's been really good this season and he got a goal and an assist. And Roy Hodgson was saying that when he came back into the changing room following his media duties, he got a spontaneous round of applause from the dressing room. And it just, you know, that kind of story is just what you absolutely love to see.
Yeah, I like the visual of Roy Hodgson giving Mitchell a fist bump afterwards. That was a bit of a emotional one. I quite like that. But Matthew, I'll finish with you. Is there anything you want to say about Fulham this week?
No, other than the fact that Fabio Carvalho is going to be an absolute star. And I will say now, a lock for Championship team of the season next year.
Okay. And on that note, you mentioned the Championship. It's time to dabble in some dark arts because I need to do some juju again. Because once again, I need to say that Brentford are the best football team in the world. And you know what happened on Monday night as they lost. So fingers crossed that happens again, Matthew. My work here is done, or half done at least.
Yeah, as much, you're doing as much as you can do. That's all that we can ask.
Absolutely. Right, we've hit full time pretty much. So I just need to do the admin. It's the penultimate show. We've got one more to go. We're nearly there. So Max, a sterling performance as always. I look forward to doing it again on our final show next week.
Yeah, thanks very much. Looking forward to the season ender.
Top man. Matthew, thank you for your time this afternoon. I hope you enjoyed that one.
Indeed, I did. Pleasure as always.
Lovely stuff. And Carl, thanks for wearing the captain's armband this week. A pleasure to chat to you once more.
Yeah, really enjoyed it, Dan. Appreciate it, mate.
Lovely stuff. Fantastic. Right, cheers, guys, and also to the listeners out there. With that said, it just leaves me to say that my name's Dan Tracy. This is The Real Football Cast. And until next time, goodbye.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.